Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the antidote to the just-published celebration of the wealthiest Americans, the Forbes 400 list, and speak with Shannon Moriarty, the Communications Director of United for a Fair Economy. They just published the Born on Third Base report, which demonstrates how many of the billionaires that a lot of average Americans aspire to join inherited their wealth. Then, following Mitt Romney's categorization of 47% of Americans as victims, we will explore the psychology of reverse victimization, where many rich conservatives see themselves as victims of higher taxes that support freeloaders and a liberal mainstream media that does not appreciate their value. Robert Samuels, the president of the University Council, joins us. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Romney's Victim Identification: What Really Drives Right-Wing Politics. Then finally, we will discuss the so-called one-state solution between Israel and Palestine with two authors who will be speaking at a forum, What Happens After Zionism? Marcy Newman, the author of The Politics of Teaching Palestine to Americans, joins us, along with Anthony Lowenstein, the author of a new anthology, After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine. They will discuss their ideas for a new way forward in the stalled so-called peace process. And joining us now is Shannon Moriarty, who's the Communications Director of United for a Fair Economy, a non-profit public interest organization that raises awareness of how concentrated wealth and power undermines our economy, corrupts democracy, and deepens the racial divide, tearing communities apart. They have just released a report in response to this week's publication of the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans, the Born on Third Base report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shannon Moriarty.
Thank you.
And the Forbes 400, the latest report that just came out this week, shows an extraordinary change from when they first started doing this report back in 1982. To get into the 400 list, you needed only $75 million in net worth. Today, to get in at the entry level, at the 400 level, is $1.1 billion. And when they first started out, the 400 Club's total net worth was $93 billion. Today, the combined net worth of the 400 richest Americans is $1.7 trillion. So that's an extraordinary change to where the average net worth of a Forbes 400 member today is a staggering $4.2 billion.
It is, and that's precisely why we did this report. We really feel that the Forbes 400 list glamorizes wealth in America, when in fact it's never become more difficult for the average person to become a member of this exclusive 400 club. So what we did with this report was we just took a look at what it actually takes to become a member of the Forbes 400. They call it the definitive scorecard of wealth in America, but really it only focuses on the minuscule minority and not the realities of what it takes to play the game.
So the top three, of course, are Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Larry Ellison of Oracle. The first two, Gates and Buffett, do give a lot of their fortune away. But what I've learned from your report, Shannon Moriarty, Born on Third Base, is that many of these people on this list of Forbes 400 richest Americans inherited their wealth, and they spend most of their time trying to figure out ways to avoid paying taxes. There seems to be an enormous decline in altruism in this country.
Indeed. I mean, there's no doubt that a lot of this year, for the 2012 list, Forbes focused their narrative on the charitable giving that many of the members of the Forbes 400 do. And that's wonderful, and that should certainly happen. But the purpose of our report was to point out that about 40% of the 2011 Forbes members inherited a sizable asset from a spouse or family member. So 40% of the 400 richest Americans inherited something that gave them a huge head start. 20% of the list, just over 20% of the 2011 list, 21.25%, inherited sufficient wealth to make the list just by inheriting money. That is a huge portion. But yet Forbes wrote this year that they wanted to assure us that 70% of the list made their fortunes entirely from scratch. So even though 40% of the list inherited a sizable asset from a spouse or family member, Forbes is concluding that 70% of the list made their fortunes entirely from scratch, and that just doesn't seem to make much sense. So we really wanted to point out that many of those on the Forbes 400 list are a part of an exclusive club, whether it be a family dynasty or a very privileged minority of the U.S. who enjoyed some birthright privileges that most people just don't have. Another important observation of the list from 2011 is that family dynasties really persist in this country. 17% of the 2011 Forbes list have family members on the list. So a few recognizable names are the Cargills or the Waltons. And the same thing can be said for the 2012 list.
So, again, I'm speaking with Shannon Moriarty, who's the Communication Director of United for a Fair Economy, and they've just released a report in response to the Forbes 400 list published this week of the 400 richest Americans. Their report is called Born on Third Base. Now, people who are born on home base are, I guess you just mentioned the Waltons and the Cargills. Mm-hmm. Also, there's the Mars candy fortune, Forrest Mars. Again, a zealous advocate of privilege and paying minimal taxes. The other is Bill Marriott, who's, I think, isn't he the biggest donor to the Romney campaign? And Romney used to work for him as well.
Certainly. I mean, I don't know the specifics of each of the members and their political affiliations, other than a few, such as Warren Buffett, who are very out there, you know, with their political affiliations. But certainly, those who inherit this kind of wealth, many of them do a lot to try and keep it in the family. So this has led to the significant weakening of the estate tax, which of course is our nation's most progressive tax on wealth. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that before President Bush, Forbes 400 members paid an average tax rate of 30%. And after Bush was in office, this dropped to 18%. I think one interesting little side note from the report is the Cargill family. When one member of the Cargill family passed away, Mary Janet Morse Cargill died in 2010, of course, when the estate tax was completely repealed, and saved her family $750 million in estate taxes. So certainly, I think the debate about taxes and wealth, and particularly the wealthiest Americans, I think this has some real policy implications that are relevant to today's political discourse.
Well, the so-called death tax, which had been pushed by the Republicans for some time, and they still are pushing it, is such a flagrant example of how our politicians are owned by the wealthy. The proponents of repealing the so-called death tax, the John Boehners and Eric Cantors of the world, always argue about family farms being taken by the government and all this stuff, and there's absolutely no evidence of that. But as you just pointed out, the real point is that the super rich get to save millions and millions, and there's no incentive for them to invest in foundations that provide, you know, some benefit to the community, as has, you know, in the days of old, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundations, et cetera. That's what's inherent in repealing the estate tax, is that they don't have an incentive to give charitably.
Absolutely. And I mean, in my mind, this comes down to two things. We can create a system where we allow these families to perpetuate their dynasties, and we can admire their charitable gifts, which of course, as I said, that is not the focus of this report. There's a lot to be admired about, charity and whatnot. Or, you know, we can continue that way of doing things, or we can create a system where, the Forbes 400 list reflects our country. The reality is, as I mentioned earlier, you and I are less likely now more than ever before to make the Forbes 400 list. As you mentioned in the beginning, the threshold to make the Forbes 400 in 1982, 31 years ago, was 75 million. And today, every single person on the list is a billionaire, and there are probably another 100 or so billionaires who didn't even make the cut. But I think a lot can be learned from the Forbes 400 list by looking at who is not on the list. When you step back and you look at the 400 members, they are mostly older white men. There's only in 2011, and I believe in 2012, the only African American on the list is Oprah. Only 10% of the list are female. The reality is that it has, not every single person in the U.S. has ever had the equal opportunity to build wealth. Yet that's the message that Forbes is trying to spin with their list.
Again, I'm speaking with Shannon Moriarty, who's the Communication Director of United for a Fair Economy, and they have just published in response to the Forbes 400 list that came out this week, a study called Born on Third Base. Walk us through the baseball analogies, if you will, Shannon, in terms of how you've repurposed the 400 list into a kind of baseball analogy.
Sure. So our methodology is very similar to that used by Forbes in determining the assets of each individual. The difference is they start out with a much larger pool and then decide on their top 400. We take their 400 and then do our digging to learn what we can about their background. So what we do is we look at each individual, we determine what their parents did for a living and try to understand what kind of background they came from. Did they grow up in a poor, lower working class family, middle class? What kind of schooling did they have? Was it private school, anything like that? So the way we break it down is our lowest category is the batter's box. So these are individuals who came from a lower or middle class background. And for the 2011 list, we found that 35% of the list was born in the batter's box. A few examples of those people would be Oprah, Larry Ellison, Harold Hamm. The first base is for individuals who had opportunities that gave them some kind of an advantage, such as an upper-class background, inheriting assets of less than $1 million or receiving some startup capital from a family member. We found that 22% of the 2011 list were born on first base. For second base and
by the
third
way, that,
base...
By the way, that includes first base, born on first base includes Mark Zuckerberg, right? And he's the Facebook founder.
That's right.
But his fortune has diminished, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, indeed. And interestingly enough, he's referred to in the narrative for the 2012 list as one of the losers on the list, which I found really interesting that they could consider a billionaire on the Forbes 400 a loser because his assets declined. But I guess that's another story.
Right.
But Mark Zuckerberg was born into a very comfortable, well-educated family and, of course, attended an exclusive prep school, went on to Harvard, and of course, is a white male. So there's no denying there are some advantages that come with that. I will say for second and third base, it's harder to delineate the differences between second and third base. For second base, we say that these are people who inherited a medium-sized business or wealth of more than $1 million or received substantial startup capital. For third base, we included people who inherited wealth in excess of $50 million or a large and prosperous company. I will say that it becomes difficult to determine exactly the value of the assets inherited by people. So it's very likely that many of the people we put on first base in being conservative with our estimates, it's very possible that they could have been on second or third or even home. But again, we wanted to be more conservative with our estimates.
So just to have some of the people that we're talking about on second and third base, you've got Donald Trump, and of course, he's always exaggerated his wealth. It's hard to know. I mean, he clearly wants to keep his day job on television. And the Koch brothers as well, right? They're,
that's right. Yep.
And Marriott and Mars, as we mentioned earlier.
Yes. Yep. These are all people who inherited a company from their parents. Those born on home plate inherited enough wealth to make the Forbes 400 list. And we found that 21.25 of the 2011 list were born on home plate.
And that's like the Waltons, the Cargills, any others that come to mind?
No, the Waltons and the Cargills right there. I mean, you have portion of the list right there. So
I keep repeating this stunning statistic, which I know is starting to sound like a broken record, that the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, own the equivalent wealth of 40% of Americans at the lower end of the economic scale. 40% of all Americans have the wealth equivalent to that one family who still clip coupons and who screw their workers to the bone, won't provide them with proper health care. It's an obscenity.
But they give to charity, right?
So, well,
that's the spin that's happening this year. Another really interesting statistic is the Cargill McMillan family members. So, of course, the Cargills, that name doesn't stand out as much as the Waltons, but the Cargill family is the commodities agricultural giant who is one of the largest producers of corn, sugar, beef, and grain. So the prevalence of high fructose corn syrup and pretty much, a huge portion of things in our grocery stores, that all that money flows to the Cargills.
So they're essentially making a fortune out of poisoning America. I mean, some of the most recent studies, particularly on childhood obesity, indicates that the main culprit in the obesity epidemic in this country, and particularly among children, is high fructose corn syrup.
Right, and so this is the Cargill McMillan family, and they do a very deliberate and I would say successful job of keeping their family name and their company affiliation very secret.
It's a private. It's a privately held company, right?
That's right. So they aren't required to disclose any of that information. Right. So Cargill McMillan family members who are inheriting just 1/18th of the family fortune are still inheriting enough wealth to put them on the Forbes 400, which is also pretty staggering, I would say.
So, Shannon Moriarty, how many of these people are isn't the Mars also a private company, no public shares?
I don't have that information, but I think that what you will find is for a lot of these families, these people who are born on home plate tend to be very private about that and tend to do their advocacy, off the radar.
I see. So tell us about some of the new wealthy, these hedge funds people like John Paulson, who are beneficiaries of this new Wall Street-dominated economy, which is referred to as the financialization of the American economy, which is now up to about 50% of the economy, is controlled by Wall Street. And they don't produce things in the old-fashioned way that the Henry Fords and the Thomas Edisons did. They just move money around and play games with computerized programs, et cetera, but yet end up making massive amounts of wealth.
Yeah, well, we found that nearly one quarter of the Forbes list earned their fortunes from financial speculation. And this is, of course, since tax rates on investment income are far lower than those on, income from a paycheck that you get from working a 40-hour week. So our tax system is structured in a way that if you are somebody with a hedge fund who's playing with money all day, you will be allowed to keep a greater portion of it than if you are doing actual labor. So we found that finance on the 2011 list, we found that finance is the largest source of fortunes for members of the list.
So just in closing then, Shannon Moriarty, what's the takeaway from this list? Because we're becoming more aware of this, of not just the divide and the growing disparity in wealth in this country, but following the leak of those secret tapes, the secret taping of Mitt Romney at a hedge fund billionaire's home in Boca Raton back in May, where he exhibited this disdain for 47% of Americans, as suggesting that they're victims who are waiting for government, who depend on government handouts. And now, of course, that's become a part of this presidential race. But I think it indicates an attitude. What you're suggesting here is that the Forbes 400 list is really a celebration of these people. And you're trying to say, wait a minute, what are you trying to say?
We're trying to say that the Forbes 400 list is a calculatedly glamorized tale of the self-made man narrative. It misleads by minimizing the myriad of factors that enable people's wealth. And also, it fails to tell the whole story of wealth in America. And that the real story is that today it is less likely than ever before that the average person who isn't born with privilege will make the list.
And just tell me, what's the URL?
The URL is faireconomy.org, and we also have a petition where we are asking people to pressure Forbes to tell the whole story of wealth in America, so people can visit us at faireconomy.org to sign that. And we also have a deck of Forbes 400 All-Star baseball cards that people can order if they're interested.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Shannon Moriarty.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Shannon Moriarty, who's the Communication Director of United for a Fair Economy, a non-profit public interest organization that raises awareness of how concentrated wealth and power undermines our economy, corrupts democracy, and deepens the racial divide, tearing communities apart. They have just released a report in response to this week's publication of the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans, the Born on Third Base report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Romney's rich supporters see themselves as victims.
Oh, the grocers, though we have fun. Tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
The tax man's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon. And I can't sail my yacht, he's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Samuels, who's the president of the University Council AFT and a lecturer at UCLA. He's also the author of the popular blog Changing Universities and the book New Media, Cultural Studies and Critical Theory After Postmodernity. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Romney's Victim Identification, What Really Drives Right-Wing Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Samuels.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously, the Romney surreptitious tape that was recorded back in May in Boca Raton, Florida, at the home of a wealthy hedge fund manager, has created quite an impact on this race. And of course, the notion, as Romney expressed, that 47% of Americans see themselves as victims dependent upon the government for handouts. You're turning that somewhat on its head, aren't you, here, by suggesting that, in fact, the wealthy elites who were present at that fundraiser in Boca Raton, Florida, also see themselves as victims. Not only do rich conservatives see themselves as victims of high taxes and government regulation, they also feel that they are under attack by liberal culture, the mainstream media, and higher education. So elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, I just realize I've been spending a lot of time with wealthy Republicans, and every time I'm with them, they complain about all of the business regulations. They complain about the, you know, high taxes they have to pay. They complain about immigration. They complain that, you know, you can't be a Christian anymore because there's all of these secular rules and laws or culture. And so I think something that needs to be exposed is this kind of long history in the conservative movement of seeing themselves as victims. And, you know, this is part of the Southern strategy starting after the Civil Rights, where basically in order to call for tax cuts, and also is a new form of prejudice, where they basically said that, you know, poor people, especially poor people of color, victimize the wealthy by making the wealthy pay taxes. And so if, and part of the argument is, if we live in a post-prejudice society, then we don't need welfare anymore. And if we don't need welfare, then we don't need government. And if we don't need government, then we don't need taxes. And so there's this kind of underlying argument for the last 40 years in for the conservatives that basically we don't really have any victims, and the true victims are the conservatives, the wealthy people who have to pay for everyone else.
So do you think then that, as Rush Limbaugh urged Mitt Romney to double down on his comments that were recorded surreptitiously, that in other words, to go public with it, as he has done, he's appeared to have taken the offensive rather than apologize for insulting half of Americans. He's now running on that issue. So does that mean that what you're saying, actually, there's a great constituency in white America that Romney's now feeding?
You know, I think there's like 30-35% of the people who probably really relate to that and like that. And he was at a fundraiser where he was appealing to his base, and especially his wealthy base. And so that's an argument that will go over well with that audience. But in the general election, if he really needs to pick up swing voters or independent voters, I think it's going to be very difficult, especially if people feel they're being attacked, and especially if, like, you know, people on Social Security are part of the 47%, or returning military people are part of the 47%, or they said there's 4,000 millionaires who are part of the 47% who pay no federal income tax, you know. And that's the other side that I wanted to say, is that, you know, there's a little bit of projection here, like the idea that basically, you know, he's attacking people for not paying taxes. Well, everyone's been saying he hasn't been paying taxes, and we know that he's been able to get away with paying very little taxes, and we don't know for several years if he paid any taxes. And so he's attacking poor people for not paying taxes. And on the other hand, you know, he's one incredibly wealthy person who pays very little taxes, and he's also attacking poor people for feeling entitled, but he seems incredibly entitled. He feels that, you know, the government should be structured for the wealthy and should help the, what he calls, you know, the creators, the job creators. And so he feels incredibly entitled. And his whole money that he made from private equity, so much of that is based on manipulating the tax code, and also making these companies take on a lot of debt, and then using that debt to pay high fees to the private equity company, people like Romney, and then they don't have to pay taxes, or they can pay deferred taxes or limited taxes because it's called carried interest. And so they've lobbied hard to get all of these, you know, basically corporate welfare, and private equity would not exist if they didn't have these tax breaks. And so I think it's, you know, very ironic, you know, for him to attack poor people for, you know, not paying enough taxes or for profiting from the government.
So do you think, though, that Romney believes it, and he's the beneficiary, and so are the wealthy? They own the government, it's pretty clear, and they get all the benefits. They pay less taxes average than their secretaries do, and that's been going on for some time. I'm wondering whether this is an honest belief or a tactical belief. In other words, if you keep hoisting this canard all the time that there's such a thing as a liberal media, and I'm speaking to you from Pacifica here in Los Angeles, and we're, you know, supposedly the liberal media, and I know that we're not a powerful voice, and nothing compared to Fox News. So it's a hoax, the idea of the liberal media, but the effect that it has is it keeps moving the goalpost to the right. Because if you invent a nemesis, then, you know, you have to respond to it, even though it's a straw man.
Yeah, and you know, one of the crazy things about this is, you know, it's really crazy because the book Kitty the Billionaire, and somehow the very, very wealthy people, like the 1%, have gotten people to feel sorry for them. You know, they're sorry for them because they have to pay all these taxes, or they're sorry for them because they're regulated, or they're sorry for them that they're being attacked in the media. And so I think the strategy in many ways has worked. And when I talk to very wealthy Republicans here in Santa Barbara, a lot of them really feel deep down that they're victims. They feel that they're being, you know, restrained by the government, that they're paying a ton of taxes, that they're getting, that their money is going to pay for to education for immigrants or illegal immigrants. And so they really feel deep down that they are being abused. Now, that might be a rationalization, a way of hiding their guilt, but it allows them, like Romney, to basically cut off and not think about other people. So he says, like, I don't have to worry about those 47%. I mean, it's really like class consciousness. It's like those other people don't exist. And I think this is part of the whole rationalization, how they rationalize being so, you know, having such an unequal society.
Again, I speak with Robert Samuels, the president of the University Council and lecturer at UCLA. He's also the author of the popular blog Changing Universities and the book New Media, Cultural Studies and Critical Theory After Postmodernity. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Romney's Victim Identification, What Really Drives Right-Wing Politics. Now, in your world at the University of California, of course, Robert, you mentioned University of California versus Bucky, who was a white male applying to medical school, and he managed to sue under affirmative action by turning the white majority into victims of special preferences for minorities. They won, didn't they?
I mean, yeah, that's a classic case, and it really, I think, is one of the major cases in this reversed racism. So suddenly you have this situation where basically the wealthy white people are considered the victims, and the people, say, people of color are considered the victimizers, and you have this complete reversal, and it feeds into this whole idea of the welfare queen, or this notion that Obama is the food stamp president, because I think that was very interesting. You know, it's not just like that he's giving food stamps to everyone and making them dependent on him, but basically, you know, a black person has to be on food stamps. Like, even the president is really on food stamps. That's the kind of the mental imagery or the symbolism. Mm-hmm. And so one of my, you know, arguments is that a lot of this politics is really highly irrational. It's highly symbolic, but it works. It's effective.
And, of course, very effective in terms of Proposition 13 here in California, which has changed the entire state and led to minority rule by a small group of hardline Republicans who have essentially been controlling a blue state through minority rule. That, of course, was hoisted on the notion that wealthy people were victims of higher taxes and that this money was going to minorities. And they successfully have changed the entire state. And the evidence is that the education system is broke, but the prison system is full of monies being poured at it.
And we see, like, this other target now, it's like the teachers, you know, the other horrible people. Like, teachers are represented now as, like, almost criminals in the popular press and in a lot of the politicians, and, you know, the public employees, the unions, the pensions, and people don't look at how, like, Wall Street and Wall Street excess and fraud, you know, caused all of these pension funds to lose so much money, and now they're going after the pensions of the public employees, and they're not even looking at, well, what was the cause of this, you know, and how do we prevent this from happening again? And so no one is looking at the excesses of Wall Street. And instead, once again, like, the poor workers are the, you know, victimizers, and Wall Street sees themselves as victims somehow.
Well, of course, the Republican Party is, and that's why Romney, the moderate from Massachusetts, is now a rabid right-winger, is because of how much it's moved to the right, and a lot of that's to do with the Christian right. There was a book recently by Rush Limbaugh's brother about how Christianity and Christians in this country were a beleaguered minority being beaten up by the liberal elite. And I don't know, that seems to be another example of this peculiar reverse victimization that conservatives have managed to manufacture here. The idea that Christians are under assault in this country by a bunch of gays who want to get married.
Or if you listen to, you know, if you watch Fox News, you know, they're always constantly saying, oh, they're trying to get rid of Christmas. The secular people are trying, you know, you can't even have a Christmas tree out. You can't have a cross out. You can't be a Christian. And so it's, you listen to Fox News and it's all about the wealthy or the powerful being victims. And so I think, you know, that psychology has to be really exposed and challenged.
Well, one of the examples you give in your article, Robert Samuels, is that when Sarah Palin was running for vice president, she interpreted any criticism of her lack of knowledge as a sexist attack by the liberal media. And she was, you know, the conservatives rallied around her and made her a victim of this so-called liberal press and the liberal elite. And, you know, I mean...
the key to being a victim is, you know, that... Once you're labeled, you see yourself as a victim, then you feel justified attacking other people, and you feel that anything is justified and that you can't be criticized because you're pure and innocent, you're the victim. And so by reversing the relationship and making the wealthy the victims, then basically they feel justified attacking other people or, you know, mistreating other people because they feel that, you know, that's their just desert or that they're entitled to it. The wealthy feel entitled to attacking other people because they've been victimized by paying taxes or being criticized by the press.
Well, just in closing, given that that this Romney tape has certainly got the so-called liberal media all excited as though that's going to knock Romney out of the race, and as I mentioned earlier, it seems like it's also working in a paradoxical way to enliven his base as well. So what do you think is the antidote to this fraud that's being perpetrated on the part of the wealthy white elite to portray themselves as victims?
You know, I think really politicians have to take it head on, and they're afraid to do that because they're afraid of once in a while. They're afraid of, once again, of being called victimizers. They don't want to be called like the liberal attack dogs, and so they don't want to actually go out. But they have to expose this because it's been going on for like 45 years, and you know, one of the parts is this coded racism, too, because they're constantly basically attacking poor people and people of color, but they do it in this kind of symbolic way or indirect way, and it has to be exposed, otherwise it's going to continue to circulate.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Samuels.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Samuels, who's the president of the University Council and a lecturer at UCLA. He's also the author of the popular blog Changing Universities and the book New Media, Cultural Studies and Critical Theory After Postmodernity. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Romney's Victim Identification, What Really Drives Right-Wing Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with two advocates of the so-called one-state solution between Israel and Palestine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Marcy Newman, a teacher, writer, and activist who for the past 6 years has been living and teaching in Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon. She's the co-founder of the Nahel Bared Relief Campaign and the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and is the author of The Politics of Teaching Palestine to Americans, the proceeds of which are donated to the Middle East Children's Alliance. And also joining us is Anthony Lowenstein, who's an independent Australian journalist, activist, and blogger. He's the author of two books, My Israel Question and The Blogging Revolution, and co-editor of Left Turn. He has written for The Guardian, The Nation, Huffington Post, Haaretz, and other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing to both of you, Marcy Newman and Anthony Lowenstein.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Let me begin with Marcy. In terms of the event tonight that you all appearing at, What Happened After Zionism, I take it that the theme is that the two-state solution is dead and that the only way to proceed is a one-state solution. So why would you assume that the Israeli government would be more receptive to a one-state solution than they've been to a two-state solution?
I think that the evening's event is sort of situated around Antony's book and the questions he raises, so I think that would be better addressed to him. For me, my work is about educating people about Palestine in order to elicit an end to Zionism.
Well, let me ask you that question, Antony, since it's obviously better directed at you.
Sure. I think in many ways one of the reasons behind the book was to say that so much of the public debate about Israel-Palestine revolves around the question of, if only the two sides, Israel and Palestine, got together, they sat down in a room, some kind of equitable peace could be brought, a two-state solution, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. And there's no doubt that anyone who spends any time in Palestine will realize that the intention of Oslo, the peace accords that were signed roughly 20 years ago, was in fact the opposite of that. It was to enrich and enlarge and allow the Israeli occupation to continue. You ask in your question, how likely is Israel to accept a one-state solution? The short answer is right now, absolutely not. They're opposed to it implacably, because clearly a one-state solution would mean probably a minority Jewish state. This is not a question of a belief that should be imposed by force, nothing like that. It's to say that in a modern world, a discussion about what a one-state solution would look like needs to be addressed, because we're getting to the point where on the ground, a two-state solution is never going to happen. But in terms of the public debate, we're getting to the stage where more and more people are realizing that any kind of equitable sharing of land, a viable Palestinian state, simply is impossible. And therefore, a democratic secular state with both peoples and all the issues that entails, and we talk about that in the book, should be discussed now when the conversation begins in a much more major way in the public in the next years.
And Marcy Newman, what's your sense of the current state of the Palestinian question? Because it seems to me that what Prime Minister Netanyahu has managed to do is, because he keeps talking about Iran all the time, he's managed to successfully shift the focus to Iran and make the Palestinians again invisible. And I think it's a deliberate tactic on his part, because he doesn't really have a solution. And he says he wants peace, but he doesn't really ever get to talk about it. They talk about talking about peace, but they don't actually. So we have a process, a peace process, but we don't have peace. And that's been going on for some time. So in terms of the kind of decade-long fraud, if you will, where do we stand today?
I mean, for where I live in Lebanon, this is not how things are framed, and this is not how the media portrays things. And so it's, in fact, Palestinians are not invisible in the media where I live. So I think that for me, in terms of what I'm consuming and what I'm seeing on TV and in the newspapers, it's very much about Palestinians who have been in the streets, both protesting the Palestinian authorities, complicity and collusion with the Israeli regime and the way that it is basically enforcing Israeli policies in the West Bank, about what's happening in Gaza with the ongoing assault on Gaza that has never ended. So this is sort of what I see and what I hear on a daily basis. So I'm not really subjected to a lot of the things that I think people are subjected to here in terms of the media. But I would also add that, you know, locally in Los Angeles, you know, yesterday and also last week, I participated with Dump Veolia Los Angeles in speaking at City Hall against the new Veolia contract with the Los Angeles with the municipal bus system. And we had 33 people speaking with us on that day. And there were only 4 people from the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles and from Veolia Corporation who were speaking against it. I mean, for me, that suggests that things are shifting in some ways, that things are progressing and that people are waking up to what's right and what's wrong, what's moral and what's not.
But, Antony, surely the assumption's always been that the United States is is the 900-pound gorilla in the room, isn't it? That they're supposed to be the ones that are going to broker a peace if there's ever to be a peace. And that I assume, is why Israel has so successfully influenced American politics. So what's your sense of what it's going to take to change opinions in America about getting serious about a solution, whether it's a two-state or a one-state, but, you know, something?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt, as you rightly say, that the American position for 20 years, in fact, really frankly, since the establishment of Israel, with a few exceptions here and there, has been uncritically supportive of Israel. The occupation in the West Bank, which now has roughly 700,000 Jewish settlers living there illegally, could only have happened with the support and funding and defence of the US and indeed my country, Australia, and many other Western states as well. What I think, and Marcy is correct on this, there is at the moment a bit of a disconnect between often public opinion and certainly a surge in discussion about the issue and the political reality. In the US Congress, as anyone who knows this issue will say, it's almost like the only way you can get far in your career in this country, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is to be blindly pro-Israel. But in public opinion and public discussion, there is a shift going on. How that's going to be reflected in kind of political policy is yet to be seen. But certainly in many other countries around the world, much of Europe, parts of the UK, parts of Australia and elsewhere, there has been a growing awareness that by remaining silent about what Israel is doing, in fact, the great irony, and this is one thing, I say this as a Jewish person myself, that by Israeli actions, blind support from the US or any other country, in fact, is killing the chance of Israel actually existing as any kind of independent entity. I mean, continued colonization can only continue. The only way it can continue indefinitely is essentially continuing to colonize Palestinian land, which means that a Jewish state, which is a Jewish majority state, which is what Zionists and Israel and the US says should happen, is actually going to be impossible simply on demographic reality, where in the next, we don't know when, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, soon, there's going to be a minority Jewish population in both Palestine and Israel. So the short-term thinking about this, I think, is why these discussions like tonight, and I've been doing a book tour for the book in Israel, Palestine, the UK, and now the US, is important, because unless we talk about what's going to happen next, we're going to be pretty unprepared for the reality.
So, Marcy Newman, at the Democratic Convention, of course, we all witnessed the roll call by Mayor Villaraigosa to change some of the platform to include God and also to include the capital of Israel as Jerusalem. And I think most fair-minded people watching that recognize that they didn't get a two-thirds affirmative. The nays actually were at least as loud as the yeas. And also now, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu has argued that he's not getting involved in the U.S. elections, which he clearly is. His biggest supporter is Sheldon Adelson. He's the biggest donor so far to Mitt Romney. And now we learn that a front group called Secure America Now, which is run by a group of neoconservatives, are buying a lot of ad time in Florida to influence the Jewish vote down there in favor of Romney against Obama. So what's your sense of where we stand in terms of what was indicated in at the Democratic Convention was that blind support, as Anthony just said, for Israel is perhaps on the wane?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, one thing for our mayor here in Los Angeles that he should be reminded of is Los Angeles was one of the first U.S. cities to divest from South Africa under apartheid. And so I think that, especially with the Veolia campaign here.
By the way, you've mentioned that before, and just give us a quick sketch of what that is, because I'm not up on that.
Veolia is a French company that has built a Jewish-only rail system that connects Jerusalem to settlements in the West Bank. And so there are many cities in Europe that have boycotted Veolia, including two French cities. And so we have a campaign here in Los Angeles to get rid of contracts with Veolia as a result of that. So there is a precedent in Los Angeles, which our mayor should be conscious of going with the moral position. SB 1070 in Arizona, we were one of the first cities to be on board with the boycott of Arizona. So, I mean, I think we need to do a better job of connecting these issues for Los Angelinos and our government here to make sure that they can be on the right side of history again.
And Anthony, given that you're from Australia, and Australia, I suppose, has followed pretty much politically the same path as the United States, in the sense that their politicians tend to favor the Israeli position over the Palestinian position, and I don't know whether that's as a result of an equivalent in Australia to APAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, which is the big lobby here. I'm not up on Australian politics, whether they have a similar lobby. But what we did recently see from Australia, which was quite surprising, if not alarming, was demonstrations where Arab Australians were demonstrating in the streets against this movie that nobody's ever seen. And they were shouting in the streets, "Obama, Obama, we love Osama." So tell me about what's going on in Australia.
Yeah, well, I've been overseas for the last 6 weeks, but having said that, I certainly followed what was happening. There's no doubt that there were recently, a few weeks ago, a couple of, like you have in a lot of countries, a very fringe group of Muslims who express views that most other people don't like, they don't accept. I mean, we have in Australia, unlike in the US, where you have the right to free speech, here in America, in Australia, we haven't got that. And yet those people sometimes, I don't exactly know if they've been arrested, I don't think they have. But as I said, in terms of Australia's foreign policy and Australia's position in terms of the Middle East in general, we have a multicultural country. There obviously are problems with that in terms of certain groups have had more issues integrating. But more importantly, there's a sense that there's undoubtedly there's racism in Australia at the moment. The greatest group, I would say, that fuels intimidation and racism is definitely the Muslim community, particularly since September 11th, quite like a lot of other countries around the world, including here in the US. Foreign policy towards Israel-Palestine, you're right, is really very much following the US line. Australia's foreign policy arguably is decided in Washington, not in Canberra, our capital. We have an equivalent lobby to APAC. It's called AJAC. It's not directly related to APAC, but it's certainly the same mentality. I think in some ways also Australia's identity is rather confused. So on the one hand, we saw ourselves, Australia saw itself very much as part of Europe many years ago, part of the British Empire, and now, of course, its identity being part of the Pacific and part of Asia is very different. The makeup of Australia has radically shifted in the last 20, 30 years to be far more Asian and Middle Eastern. So in some ways, I think our foreign policy has not put up to that. So we still follow blindly the U.S. line on Israel-Palestine. We were in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Americans. It's pretty much, if there was an attack, and we all hope there's not on Iran from Israel or the U.S., Australia inevitably would support that. So there is very much a challenge in Australia, and it's certainly a vocal and growing minority of individuals who are advocating for that. And finally, unlike the U.S., in Australia you've seen in the last 10 years in public opinion a profound shift in support for the Palestinian cause. Whereas years ago, most Australians, like indeed most Europeans, many years ago at least, supported the Israeli position. These days, that's changed. So America really is quite isolated in terms of public opinion. Again, obviously, there are many Americans who don't support Israel, but in terms of the mainstream public opinion polls, Australia is following very much other parts of the world, and that, I think, concerns many Israel lobbyists in my country.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let me begin with Marcy Newman and talk about what you're going to be talking about tonight. What happens after Zionism?
I'm going to be talking about how we get there, which means educating Americans and especially Los Angelinos about Palestine and as a means to disrupt Zionism or get beyond Zionism.
And Anthony, obviously you're going to be talking about your new anthology, After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine. But tell me what you're going to be presenting tonight.
Yeah, well, I'll be talking a little bit about the book, but it's not going to be a shameless speaking alone. It's also, I think, going to be a discussion about how I think public opinion is shifting and kind of the reflections I've had on the book tour I've had so far in terms of the response in Palestine, Israel itself, which clearly is a central point in terms of moving this debate forward. And I think also articulating the ways in which what a one-state solution might look like. I think often when people hear that idea, they say, well, some state in theory, but what does it actually mean? And the book provides a number of essays by Palestinians, by Jews, by others, to articulate what a democratic state would look like and why increasing numbers of Palestinians and a small number of Israelis, but that is shifting, do believe that a democratic one state, in fact, is the only way forward. So how do we get there, basically?
Well, just in closing, though, Arsi, when the title of the talk is What Happens After Zionism, where does the assumption come that that Zionism is over?
Again, that's not me. That's Anthony's book. But, I mean, because I don't see its demise yet. I look forward to that day, but I don't, you know, see it on the horizon.
Let me ask Anthony then. Why do you assume that there's a post-Zionism about to happen?
We don't think in the book, and no one is arguing that Zionism is about to end tomorrow. It's more, in some ways, it's supposed to be, A, a provocative title, but B, imagining the fact that growing numbers of both Jews in America and elsewhere, that the image of Zionism in Israel globally has never been worse. So therefore, we think it's vital to have a conversation about the destructive nature of what Zionism has done, both to the Palestinians, but also to the Jewish community, both here and Jews in general, that it's allowed discrimination to be almost accepted under the guise of the protection of a Jewish state. So we think it's important to talk, and I say this, as I said, as a Jew, and many other Jews and non-Jews argue this as well, Zionism itself is the problem here. So it's not about to end tomorrow, but let's try and imagine a world in which that Jews can live safely, that goes without saying, but in a way that doesn't discriminate against Palestinians in the process.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Anthony Lowenstein, again, an independent Australian journalist, activist and blogger. He's the author of the new anthology, After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine, and also The Israel Question and The Blogging Revolution. And he's the co-editor of Left Turn, and he's written for The Guardian, The Nation, Huffington Post, Haaretz, and other prominent publications. And also joining me in studio is Amasi Newman, a teacher, writer, and activist who for the past 6 years has been living and teaching in Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon. She's the co-founder of the Nar El Barad Relief Campaign and the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and is the author of The Politics of Teaching Palestine to Americans, the proceeds of which are donated to the Middle East Children's Alliance. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the discussion continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll be right back.